Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3. And today in the conference room at the Lataw Recovery Center, I'm here with Daryl Keim, who is the director of the Recovery Center. Welcome, Daryl.
Well, thank you, Johnny.
I want to talk a little bit today about the Recovery Center and the Rural Crisis Center Network, which are all kind of under the same roof here, and find out or let our listeners know a little bit about what's happened during the time of COVID and kind of overall history and kind of let people know exactly how it all works and why we think it's a benefit to the community here in Moscow and Lataw County in general. Why don't you start out by telling the listeners a little bit about your professional history and how you wound up with the short stick as being director of the Lataw Recovery Center.
My professional history. You're going to lose listeners right away with this boring talk. I spent 10 years professional Boy Scout.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really where was my first career, so to speak. My first job right out of getting a degree over Wazoo was I went to work for Sojourners Alliance. And I was hired to run a thrift store they had at the time called Wise Buys Thrift Store, which was on Jackson Street. It was a little thrift store. And the idea was that anybody that went to Sojourners Alliance and stayed at Sojourners Alliance had to be participating in ongoing education or be learning how to work. Right. So it was a work program for them.
Okay.
So I trained folks in how to work in a retail environment. Just really basic things I trained them too, like show up on time. If you're not going to come in, call in sick. Don't wear hot pants and a tight top. Just really basic stuff.
Sure.
So that kind of got me started in human services. Okay. And I did a few other things. And like I say, I then worked for the Boy Scouts for about 10 years and had a lot of fun with the Boy Scouts. By working with the Boy Scouts, I learned how to work with nonprofits.
Okay.
And I learned how to work with committees of volunteers, recruit volunteers, train volunteers, organize large-scale activities, fundraise some more, things like that. So that got me going down the path of nonprofits pretty strongly with nonprofit management.
Right.
Did a few other things after I stepped back from the Boy Scouts, and I ended up working for the Department of Health and Welfare for a little while. And that's what directly got me involved with starting up this nonprofit was the Department of Health and Welfare as what's called a community resource development specialist, which is a really fancy way of saying it was my job to know of the different resources in North Central Idaho that the Department of Health and Welfare might want to tap into or might want to grow.
Okay.
Towards the end of my time there, they came to me and said, hey, we've got this idea to try and start recovery community centers. And what we would like you to do is to develop a grassroots effort to start something in North Central Idaho. And then they also said, oh, and by the way, we're phasing your job out in about a year and a half to 2 years.
So get busy.
It was pretty much the implication there. And I could see the writing on the wall. They were nice enough to give me plenty of advance notice that maybe I could start a job for myself and I could do some good stuff. So, surprise, surprise, my hometown became a good place for a recovery community center. Seriously, though, it did come down to between Moscow and Lewiston. Both had some pros and cons, and both had lots of pros. But I seriously did believe that Moscow was the better community for the first recovery center that I would start, because I ended up starting two by accident. And I'll explain that in a minute.
Okay.
So I felt that it would be the best community because it already had a healthy recovery community going. It had a National Alliance on Mental Illness group that was successful and been running for years, obviously vibrant AA community, and people work together. So I was able to put together a committee and get it started. I promised you I'd tell you how I accidentally started a second one. So while I was making that decision of where to start, I met some people down in Lewiston, obviously. And about a year after, about 6 months after we started the one in Moscow, I ran into a guy by name of Eric, and he heard what we were doing. He got all excited, and he was the right guy.
Oh.
You know, he was the guy that was politically connected in Lewiston and all that. So he started pulling together people, and they started looking at what we were doing up here, had me come down to their planning meetings and help them get started with the, what became the First Step for Life also.
Good, yeah. Good.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
It's nice how, something you said about, you know, the communities work together. And, I found that to be really true before the Recovery Center came in here, because there's always a lot of cross between AA, NA, NAMI yeah. people coming through and talking and getting together. So, yeah, that's yeah. totally cool.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of crossover. And definitely there's some folks that just deal with alcoholism or just deal with narcotics. But
right.
there's probably more people, in my experience, that are dealing with multiple addictions. And any one 12-step anonymous program or one support group doesn't cover their full range of need.
That's right. That's well, and I know that to have been my case, because along with the alcoholism came the depression and mental illness, and yeah, there was a certain amount of drug abuse in there too.
Yeah. So going back to the history, I should probably come around and mention also the role that the state of Connecticut played in our getting started.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was contacted to start a recovery center, or that grassroots effort, after the state sent a delegation of folks, including Latah County Commissioner at that time, Tom Stroshine,
right.
over to check out the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery, which is kind of the national model for recovery coaching and for recovery community centers. They were very instrumental in getting that vision going nationwide. So the Idaho sent over a delegation, liked what they saw, and that's why they decided to try and build some in the state of Idaho.
Wow, all the way from Connecticut. That's crazy.
Yeah. God and now bless. They're all over the U.S.
Yeah.
Not CCAR itself.
Right.
But recovery community centers, we're no longer unusual.
I think people will be interested in a short history of how this got started. I mean, who and, we know when the doors opened in 2015, but what did it look like building up to that actual opening?
Well, when the state contacted me and I ultimately decided to look at Moscow, my first call was to the Latah County Commissioner that had gone over and seen CCAR.
Mm-hmm.
So I called Tom Stroshine, and you can blame Tom Stroshine for getting this started.
And typically
he
I do.
He gets the credit.
Yeah.
Or the blame, depends on how you want to look at it. So that's how it got started, was Tom and I talking, and Tom saying, yeah, I saw this really cool thing, and here's how excited people were when I was touring that facility, and they took us all around Connecticut. You know how Tom can tell stories.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
So he told me all about it, and we went from there.
And he was a board member here up yep. until just less than a year ago.
Less than
he
a year ago.
Retired.
Yep. He helped us build the initial startup committee that included representatives from probation, representatives from the recovery community, mostly representatives from the recovery community, but
right.
some local business representatives, and he helped us put that all together. And then Gritman got involved. He helped us make contact with Gritman Medical Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they strongly supported us, helping us put together a large community meeting. And I don't know about you. Have you ever been to a community meeting?
Yes.
Are they usually large and well attended, and
no.
people that are excited?
No, typically not.
Correct. So we knew we had a home run when Gritman let us use what's now the Martin Wellness Center.
Right.
And we had over 100 people show up.
Wow.
And the press. And I think we even had KLEW from down in Lewiston come up.
Right.
And we had a board of, I don't recall, maybe 5 people talking about recovery. And we introduced what we were trying to do, and people were they were charged up. It was pretty cool.
Fabulous.
A community meeting with excited and engaged citizenry that wanted to see what we were doing and talk about it. 100 people, more than 100 people.
Wow, wow. And if I recall correctly from some of the history I remember, not all of them were happy about what was going to happen.
No, not all of them were. People at that meeting were.
Okay.
At that meeting, nobody stated any unhappiness, but we definitely had to build trust in the recovery community.
Right.
Not
in the not in our town.
Well, there was some of that. We had both, actually.
Mm-hmm.
We had to build trust in the existing recovery community that we weren't coming from the outside to tell them what to do and how to be.
Right.
And I think we've done that, and we maintain that authenticity because we require over 50% of our board of directors to be in active recovery themselves.
Right.
Yeah, so we had to show them that vision and build their trust. And yeah, there was also the NIMBY folks, not in my backyard, mm-hmm. where we ran into that most apparently when we were trying to find a location. Our vision was to try and be very out about recovery, you know, not in church basements like many of the meetings are. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
But we wanted to put a face on recovery.
Right.
And as such, we wanted to be located in a prime location, which we ultimately found with the Masons Club when they rented to us on Main Street. But we went through 25 or 30 different locations we looked at. Most of them we crossed off the list ourselves. A few of them crossed themselves off our list when they said, oh, you're that recovery center, we don't want you.
Right.
Or our other tenants are worried about having your people here.
Right.
Stuff like that. And I know that the mayor was contacted about having those people downtown, to which, to his everlasting credit, he said, they're already downtown. How many bars do we have? Why can't we have a recovery center?
Good point.
Yeah, I love that.
Thanks, Bill. Well, that's a good quick overview of that. The LRC operates as a peer-to-peer counseling
Coaching program. Is a better word than counseling.
Coaching, yes. Because
counseling, you have to have a degree.
Right,
and
right.
Several different degrees that are available. Peer-to-peer coaching.
Yeah, and... Yeah. If you can give a brief explanation of that and more importantly, why we think it works or how do we know it works?
We know it works because the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the federal government in other words, has spent boku bucks to investigate whether it works, and it is a SAMHSA recommended service.
Okay.
So we know it works. It's not whether it works. And we have the backing to show that also.
Right.
Via SAMHSA again. So what is it? It is, in our case, and we're a little different than some of the other centers, but in our case, we have a couple of folks that have taken recovery coach training or peer specialist training, recovery coach training being for folks who have dealt with addictions, and peer specialist training being for folks who have dealt with mental health issues. They've taken the state training for that, which is approximately 50 to 60 hours. And they've gone through and gotten their certification, which means they've also done hundreds of hours of service time with it, being watched over by a manager mm-hmm. that's certified to do that. And they've passed the test, frankly. So in our case, what we have is a couple of folks that have pursued those certifications. And then we have a few volunteers. Honestly, COVID has hit us a little bit here. We need more volunteers. Hello out there. If you're interested, give me a call. And what they do is they manage a triage program wherein whenever somebody accesses our coaching or peer support services, they meet with our certified person first. The certified person then determines their level of need and says, hey, I need to keep meeting with this person. Or we have a level of volunteers called Recovery Peer Volunteers. Mm-hmm. That they might very well take a look and say, oh, this person just came in, they're dealing with alcohol addiction, male, roughly 40 years old. We have a volunteer that's similar in age, same gender, and dealing with a similar addiction. Maybe they're better off to talk with that volunteer rather than with the certified professional. So we have volunteers that are doing it too.
Fabulous. Yeah.
Not all of the recovery centers. I don't think that the First Step for Life, for instance, has that volunteer aspect like we do.
Right. Okay. I know in my program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is men work with men, and we find, I have found typically that the closer in age people I might sponsor are, the easier it is for them to relate to me as far as life experiences and whatnot. And my form of sobriety is... will probably be similar to what they are going to practice and go through. And you do have a staff here. Explain the kind of positions you have here and name names if you like, because I know they're important people here.
Well, sure. We're staffed by a combination of paid staff and volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
have to make my corny dad joke, as my daughters would say, and say I actually have a rod and staff, and that we have Rod that volunteers, and I often refer to thy rod and thy staff when he is here volunteering next to staff, just because it always makes him roll his eyes.
Right, right, absolutely. As I'm doing now. Yes. I hope it's not too loud.
Yes. So I have a rod and a staff. We have a staff that includes, now I got to think about it. Obviously, I'm staff.
Right.
So we've got me. That's not very exciting, though, and you guys already knew that. We have Amber is on staff. She is our recovery coach and person who runs all of our recovery coaching program. We have Sean on staff, and he is the staff that works with the crisis center, and he also runs some of the peer support services that, in conjunction with Amber. We have Casey, who is a counselor. So in addition to all of the peer support services you were talking about, we do have a counselor that works half-time here.
Right, and she is a master's level counselor.
And she also is working on some rural outreach. Specifically right now, she's been focusing on Deary, trying to get some services out there for a few hours a week. So we've got her. As long as I'm mentioning outreach, I forgot to mention that Amber has been spearheading a college student outreach, wherein, and this will start up again after school starts again, but Mondays, I think it was 1 to 3, we've got a small student office on campus, next to campus at St. Augustine's. So Amber, Casey, Sean, myself, we've got Cindy, and Cindy is one of our recovery peer volunteers. She's very good at that, and she helps keep the place clean. And I'm probably forgetting somebody, but I can't think of who. We have Carly, who is a Vista volunteer, which is why I kind of didn't think of her, but I should have. And a Vista is a volunteer in service to America, which means that she's kind of similar to a Peace Corps, but she's based in the U.S. rather than outside of the U.S.
Right, right.
And she's on a one-year term.
And that's originally how Amber became involved.
That's how Amber became involved. And Carly's job is, her job really is to man the outreach that we're doing with the students.
And and a list of volunteers.
Oh, and I forgot Ashton.
Ashton?
Yep. Ashton is the part of the crisis services team also with Sean.
Right.
So crisis services being offered 24/7, we aren't open 24/7. So we have Sean and Ashton, the trade-off being on call.
Right. And we'll cover into that coming up in a minute. Now, there's a lot of services that are offered here. When you first walk into the building, you'll notice a huge wall full of pamphlets and informational things, and a very friendly volunteer at the front desk that will help you peer through that. But I know a lot of the services that are here, you offer space for meetings for AA, NA, or Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon for people who are around alcoholics, Sexaholics Anonymous, the Latah Alliance on Mental Illness, LAMI, Recovery International, and even a codependency group. Are you pretty much open to any recovery group?
Yes.
They come and say, hey, we need a space.
We're a community center.
Right.
So we're all about the recovery community. If they need a space and we can find a time that works for them, I'm pretty much open to that. That's how we got most of those groups. You know, we didn't start Sexaholics Anonymous or AA or NA. They came to us and wanted to use the space. And we said, you bet.
Yeah. And I know from my experience that really exploded here during COVID. Because
when all the churches closed down and aren't allowing people to use the facility, and the city of Moscow has declared that we're an essential business and allows us to be open, provided people are masking and we're doing the cleaning as we're supposed to, then we became the only place in public where some groups could meet.
Right.
That said, it didn't really explode. We averaged before COVID roughly 25 groups a week meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Key to COVID, when it first hit, nobody knew what it was doing or how bad it was going to be.
Right.
You know, things cut off here just like they did everywhere. But we're back up to 25 to 30 groups per week meeting. So Well, some of those have been groups that, like, if there's a Sunday morning AA group that came over from another building that I suspect will go back when that's available. But most of them, it's just our groups that were already meeting here starting up or expanding.
Yeah, and I know it was great for, I frequent that Sunday morning meeting, and I knew it was, it was a great relief because they really didn't have any notices, just like it was at the Campus Christian Center on campus. And they just kind of said, we're closed.
Yeah.
Go figure it out. So it was a bit of a mad scramble, I know, for most of the groups. Some of them just had to go offline for a while until...
We did add Zoom as a result of that to try and help out. And I know that that Sunday morning AA group, for instance, uses Zoom. So that's been a nice addition for folks that can't make it into the facility and still want to have a meeting.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty easy to access. Go to our website, latarrecoverycenter.org, and first thing that comes up is a calendar. And if it's a group that's on Zoom, it says that on there, and you click in there, and it tells you how to access from there.
Right. It gives you the Zoom meeting number and passcode if that's required. I think most of them are anymore.
Yeah, all Zoom. Zoom requires you either have a waiting room or a passcode now.
Oh, okay. And classes. You do a lot of classes here and through the website. Positive affirmations. I think that's once a week. The writing for you, that the person that used to do this program, Recovery Radio, Nancy Casey, does. Life skills, Art with Shanda, which is a really cool one. There's even been an inner child class periodically. Is that like once a month, I think?
Yeah, people just gather around Johnny, stare at him, and take notes.
Yeah,
right. Oh, wait, it said inner child, not big child.
Not ridiculous, impulsive child, yes. That's exactly right. And you do volunteer trainings too. Getting back to the, if people are interested in helping out at the center, doing some volunteer work.
Yeah, our volunteers, we have them start at one level, and as they do more and more training, they learn different skills, they get more responsibility up till our top volunteer level, which is called a recovery peer volunteer, where they can be coaching other folks who are dealing with addictions and mental health issues.
And actually, you give most of those classes, correct?
I work with Amber on those classes. Yeah,
yeah. I've taken them, and they're all really good. I learned a lot. I thought I knew a lot, and then I went to school and found out I didn't know anything. So the LRC has a board of directors that basically steers the LRC. How do the board of directors interact with you, the director, and
they're my boss,
and the group all together?
They're my boss.
Right.
So they, I think they interact pretty well with me, considering that they're kind.
But do they come to you and say, Daryl, we want you to do this, or is it more of a reactive relationship where you, being on the ground in the mix of it, see a need for something or see a problem with something?
I'd say it's definitely more of the latter. It depends on how active different boards. And different directors on boards have different approaches to that sort of job. And some folks will be very proactive, and they'll be coming up, pointing out problems that they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a right or a wrong. I want to say that first of all. This particular board of directors at this point waits for the staff to bring an issue to them, and then they brainstorm and come up with solutions.
Okay.
And we've developed it such that at our monthly board meeting, we try and have a staff member. All staff are invited to the monthly board meeting.
Right.
And most of the staff have some sort of a very short report, like 2-minute report that they're doing on their area. They make that report, and they maybe stay for the first 15 minutes of the board meeting.
Right.
During all their other staff reports. Mm-hmm. Then the staff typically leave and the board does their thing. But we've started doing where we rotate amongst the staff, and roughly quarterly, each one of the staff members gets a chance for a bigger report. So it might be 5 to 10 minutes. More of an actual board report rather than just a quick update. And the idea there is to benefit the staff with that experience, but it also gives the board a chance to ask that person in-depth questions about what's going on in their area so that they can spot any things that they'd like to see changed.
And the board, you mentioned earlier, the board is intentionally composed of people who have some experience with recovery, either from addiction or mental health issues. How does that How do you think that benefits the center?
Well, the term in the business is called authenticity of voice. It helps us to maintain the authentic voice of the recovery community. It's not folks outside the recovery community saying, this is what you should be doing. It's the recovery community itself saying, this is what we want to do.
And that's very much like when somebody comes into the recovery center seeking recovery coaching. You don't tell them what the program is that they're going to work.
No,
they get options and they design it themselves.
Our recovery coaches and recovery peer volunteers are trained to help folks in putting together a recovery wellness plan. And as part of that, they come up with their own recovery goals.
Right.
Because, you know, you're in a different spot than I am, and I'm in a different spot than Joe who walks in off the street, or than Christy who walks in off the street too. What's a good goal for me might seem ridiculously simple for you, or it might be way too challenging.
And so I can see how the board, with the authenticity of voice, can also understand those things and work within those parameters to make good decisions for the direction that the recovery center wants to keep going into. Here's a big question. How do you keep the lights on here? How is the LRC financed? Obviously, we don't produce anything other than, hopefully sobriety and mental health. What greases the wheels here?
So the recovery community center side of what we do has a total overall budget of approximately $150,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
More than I got on me.
And we tend to be on the low side of the nine different recovery center, community centers there in the state. We tend to be on the more thrifty side than most of them. But most of them are still in that 150 to 170 range, from what I can understand. How do we pull that together? Prayer?
It's always a good start, yeah.
So in addition to our prayer, we've got it funded via a combination of grants, local funders, and state contracts. To put some numbers to that, and of course this could change this year, you never know, but last year I believe the funding looked roughly this way. Gritman Medical Center benefits from having us in town.
Right.
And they share that love back to us with a $5,000 donation since we've started every year.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Gritman. The county commissioners benefit from having us in town. And they share that love back to us with a $25,000 contribution last year. That's a couple of the bigger local donors. We do some local fundraising efforts. We had a fundraising breakfast last year. They had 450 people at it and raised $45,000. That included a very generous contribution from the state Medicaid provider, Optum.
Optum.
Optum,
right.
Idaho. Oh, Optum, we love you. So Optum Idaho was supportive of us last year to the tune of around $10,000 at the breakfast. They gave through the breakfast. They sponsored the breakfast.
Right, as well, yeah.
If you enjoyed what you ate, Optum fed you.
Right.
It was the Best Western being paid by Optum. And then numerous hundreds of small donors made up the rest of that. Then we had a soup festival last year. Soup's On.
Soup's On, yeah.
And that raised, I want to say, about $8,000.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that was people buying tickets to get soup, and we had a few smaller business sponsors. I think PAC DMS might have sponsored that. And this year we did that again, but we had to change the title a little bit. Due to COVID, it was Soup's Off.
Right, right.
And we did a mass mailing out to the folks that bought tickets and whatnot. We made about $4,000.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So, considering... We're
yeah,
pretty
considering
pleased
where people are at financially right now, that was, I think it was very generous of those people.
Yeah, and coming up March 3rd, in fact, we're doing the breakfast again, and you can guarantee we're not getting 450 people out to a breakfast this year.
Probably not going to be able to stack them as tight as they were. It was a full house last year.
Yeah, we're planning two smaller events on March 3rd, a breakfast and then a dessert.
Oh, a dessert.
Again, at the Best Western. So, but I digress.
Right.
The local funding makes up roughly a third of our budget.
Mm-hmm.
Call it $50,000, call it, no, $75,000. Makes up half our budget, in fact, by the time you put in the county commissioners. We had a contract with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare for approximately $50,000 last year.
Mm-hmm.
And then various grants. pulled it together for the rest.
And you're the, as I understand it, you're the grant go-getter.
I'm pretty much the money go-getter.
Yeah, that's, I think, is like at the top of the list of your job responsibilities is begging. Begging, Daryl will beg for
pretty much
money.
Pretty much. That's part of it, yeah.
That's a big job.
Yeah, it's fun.
Especially, well, you know, at one point I owned my own business, and when you are the only one responsible for maintaining your job, and, you know, writing those grants is not totally unlike that for you, because right. Basically you're paying your own salary at that point with the work you do. And I know you do a great job because, you know, the money keeps coming in. I saw something in a newsletter about an unsolicited grant that came in this year.
Idaho something out of Boise. It'll probably come to me in a few minutes.
Sure, no problem.
But yeah, they knew what we were doing, and they knew how COVID had hit area nonprofits. So they sent us a check for $14,285, I think is what it was.
Wow, just out of the blue. That is incredible.
It might have been the Idaho Community Foundation.
Yes, I think that's it.
Who it was.
I think that's
who Idaho it was. Community Foundation.
I was going to just randomly to my phone and look.
They'd given to us a few years ago, so they knew about us, and they just sent me a note saying congratulations. And I sent them a note back saying, "Hey, I don't recall applying for this. Can you send me a copy of my application? I just changed things over in my computer," which was true. I was not lying. And they said, "Oh no, you didn't apply." I was like, "Oh, really?" Holy crap.
We just have 14 grand laying around at the end of the application. No,
they wanted to help with COVID stuff.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
And did the Leitos Center apply for any COVID relief from the federal government?
Oh, we certainly did.
Okay.
We applied for the PPP, just like probably most nonprofits did.
Yeah.
And they gave us $15,000, which we put towards payroll.
Right.
And it did keep somebody employed.
Right.
Perfect. And then the state of Idaho this year are also recognizing the service that all of the recovery centers provide was also generous to make sure that since we couldn't do fundraisers, we'd be able to keep our doors open helping people.
Fabulous.
To the tune of, I think it was $50,000 last summer, and I think that we're still expecting another $33,000 for this year's budget. That's all thanks to the governor.
Fabulous. Well, thank you. Thank you, Governor Little, for that. Appreciate
it's kept that. Us in a healthy cash position compared to a lot of nonprofits. We're really blessed.
Well, why don't we shift gears right here and talk a little bit about the Rural Crisis Center Network.
So that is
the other side of the building here.
It is literally the other side of the building. It's the side of the building we're sitting in right now. And I want to be very clear, we don't own it. We are the site manager. We partner with the Rural Crisis Center Network, which is affiliated with Public Health, and Joyce Lyons is the project manager for the Rural Crisis Center Network.
So
I'm just the site manager, and I can answer the questions from that perspective.
Right.
She has an overall vision of not only the Moscow Center, but there's also a Rural Crisis Center Network office in Orofino, one in Lewiston, and they're trying to get one in Grangeville.
Right.
Or maybe Cottonwood, somewhere down that part.
Yeah, and we've here at Recovery Radio, we've begged Joyce Lyons to come on and talk about it, but she is about as busy as a one-armed paper hanger, and just have trouble making the connection with her. She keeps putting us in her to-do list, and I think we just keep slipping down the thing. But yeah, whatever you can tell us about.
You asked me before the meeting what a crisis intervention looks like, and it really depends on what the crisis is.
Right, because I'm sure it can come in different ways.
Right.
I mean, there could be a walk-in with somebody's dealing with...
We've had walk-ins. We've had people brought in by medical professionals. We've had people brought in by family. We've had people brought in by emergency services personnel. And really, what's bringing them in, especially with the emergency services personnel and with the medical professionals, is that they're not a case that's fit for the emergency room in that case.
Right.
So we're a behavioral health, this is a behavioral health crisis center. So that's not always a good fit for an ER, or in the case of the police bringing somebody in, they don't want to take them down to the jail perhaps too. So they take a look and they say, this person's dealing with some sort of a temporary onset crisis. Let's get them to the head of the line with counseling. And that's what we do.
Right.
Is coming into the crisis centers, basically cutting into the front of the line and getting to see a crisis counselor right away. And they can stay for up to 23 hours and 59 minutes. And then if they are still in crisis, we walk them out the door, we walk them back in the door, and we
restart the
intake process all over again. They can stay another 23 hours and 59 minutes for however long is needed. That said, the average stay is somewhere around 4 to 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Though we've had some that have stayed several days. And we have beds, or rather resting mats. Not beds, resting mats, so people can stay overnight, they can sleep. We've got a comfortable room, couch, TV with boring movies for them to watch. So it's not an uncomfortable place at all.
Right. No, I've been in there while we're actually in one of the counseling or conference rooms right now.
Yeah.
And it's well lit. It's fresh. The remodel of this was actually at one time a hair salon. And the changeover was spectacular.
Yeah, it looks nice, doesn't it?
It really does look nice. It's new, it's clean, the floors are fabulous, and it's comfortable. It's not stark. There's some nice artwork on the walls.
You even had a local artist do the art for us.
Right, and that was Rhonda, wasn't it?
Roxanne. Flowers by Roxanne.
And she did some fabulous pieces, too.
Yeah.
And also, along with, I think you said Sean and Ashton.
Used to be AJ.
Right, used to be a fine young man, graduated and on the road. They deal with people who come in, but there's a professional service that also comes in and works.
So what happens is somebody wants to access the crisis center. They could walk through our door if it's from 10 to 8, Monday through Friday at the recovery center, and we'll get them access. Or if it's after hours, because it's available 24 hours a day, or if they're coming from out of town or they're emergency service personnel and they already know how to do this, there's an 877 number. And that 877 number is available 24/7, and it goes to a central dispatch office. And what happens is you call that number, central dispatch picks up, determines that you're closest to Moscow, and they say, okay, so we're going to notify the Moscow Center to expect you. And then we get a call, no matter what time of day it is, and our on-call person then coordinates opening up the center if it's closed and getting the other folks here. And the other folks would be counselors from Scott Community Care. Right. So what happens is no matter how you came in, whether you walked in, whether you were brought in by emergency service personnel, whether it was the 877 number or you just saw us on the street and just walked in, first thing that happens is you got to do the paperwork. So we start on paperwork, and we also monitor the vitals, so blood pressure, temperature. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what all, in fact, we're monitoring the vitals, but trying to make sure that it's legitimately a behavioral health issue and not a medical issue that needs to walk down the street.
Drug overdose,
right?
Possibly, or
right. We're not a place for somebody to come out of an overdose or anything like that.
Right.
So we screen for all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
and if need be, been known to call the medics and have them take them down to the ER. So you come in, you get screened for all that, you start doing the paperwork, and as you're doing that, undoubtedly the counselor comes in from Scott Community Care, and they start doing counseling, figuring out and helping you figure out what your resources are and coming up with a crisis plan so that you're safe to leave. And like I said, usually that takes 4 to 6 hours, but we've had folks where the staff have helped them out for days as they figure out their plan and get connected with whatever it is they need to get out of crisis.
And sometimes the plan includes the LRC.
Frequently.
Good.
Yeah. One way to look at it is that the crisis center is here to help get you through the crisis, but if you're dealing with a behavioral health issue, the recovery center is here to keep you out of crisis.
So just move through the magic double doors into recovery. And we talked a little bit about the staff, so we recovered on that. And it is financed by the state through public health, right?
So the start of the crisis centers was financed by the state through public health. And I don't know the ins and outs. This is where you got to get Joyce Lyons on the radio sometime.
Right.
But they were challenged over time to build up their own funding so that the state wasn't 100% funding them. I know that includes some insurance type things in the picture, but I don't know the details enough to comment.
But that basically we can say in general,
yeah,
that the funding comes from the state.
Certainly right
and,
now.
And it will be changing, because I know it's, you don't have to have insurance to come into the
Not
crisis
at all.
Center.
You don't have to have any money at all.
However, if you are insured, that there can be a tap into that. But that happens,
I think,
on
that's,
the back end.
That's on the back end. Service does not depend upon that.
Right.
And I don't know if that's in place yet.
Oh, okay.
But I know that's part of their long-term plan, is that if your insurance will pay, then
right.
why, yes,
right.
they should.
Right. Because I know Optum was commenting on some of that
yeah.
a while back.
Yeah.
But yeah, for now, yeah, don't worry about it for sure.
Which brings us to the other side of finances. Who benefits from the financing? And that's really cool. Because we all do as taxpayers.
Right.
You know, if you think about it, most people don't know this, but if the police pick somebody up and they determine that they need to be taken down to the ER on what could be a 48 or a 96-hour hold, a mental health hold, in other
right.
words, the police have to stay at the ER the entire time. So they go into overtime just really fast. And they have to be there the whole time they're in the ER. But if they take them to the crisis center, it takes them an hour, maybe 2 hours to get them checked in. They're at a more appropriate facility, and the police don't have to stay there for 48 to 96 hours. Police love us. And that's just one part of it. If the police are taking them to the jail, you're paying for them in the jail. And I don't know what that costs, but we're cheaper.
Absolutely cheaper.
And I commented earlier when you asked about financing, and I mentioned that the Latah County Commissioners gave us $25,000. There's a reason for that. And the reason is that when we opened up the recovery center, they saw enough of a drop in their indigent fund, wherein they were paying for folks going to the ER and going to the hospital and whatnot, that we were saving them well more than $25,000 by it being open as a recovery center.
Wow. Wow.
So they shared the love back to us because they saved money substantially.
And now, boring statistics.
I've got some for you. This is why you wanted to talk to me, you told me.
Yeah.
So I, end of the year, I compiled some statistics from the day we opened to now. And
which
I looked
2015.
At...
2015.
Yeah.
Right. So
September 2015.
Years. So 20
through 11/30/2020 is what yeah. I compiled statistics for. And then I looked at how they compare to this year, because COVID makes things interesting.
Right, no doubt.
So overall, I mean, until 11/30, we've had, I measure things in what's called client contacts, because we're anonymous. I can't get people to sign in. You know,
right.
It's kind of the opposite of anonymous.
Yeah, right, yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
So instead, we log in, okay, there was an AA meeting and 12 people met.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be that you would come to your AA meeting and then stay for another meeting. So mm-hmm. you counted twice as a client contact.
Right.
But you're really only Johnny.
Right.
Right. So since 9/2015, September 1st, 2015, in fact, remember the day, we've had 39,833.8 client contacts.
0.8?
I don't know how we did that. I assume it involved a sharp knife.
Okay.
So if you like your math, you divide that out by the number of months we've been open, and you find out that we've had 642.48 client contacts per month on average for the past 5 years. That's a lot.
That's a lot of people flowing in.
Most of that is, well, AA is huge for us.
Right.
But most of that is the different support groups like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we also got recovery coaching, which we offer for free, which I explained earlier. And in the past 5 years, we've averaged, and I don't know how we did this one, 45.96 monthly recovery coaching sessions.
Well, one could have ended early.
Yeah, yeah, maybe that's it. No, I don't know. It's the miracle of math.
That's right.
So this year, how does it compare? Because, you know, COVID has impacted everybody with everything. And like I said earlier, in March and April, we were as dead as everybody else.
Oh, yeah.
But we're back.
Right.
And we're busy now. So keep in mind, the average for the past 5 years has been 642.48. The average this year for client contacts has been 560.23 per month.
That's
still
less
a lot.
Than 20%.
Yeah.
Decrease.
Yeah.
For a total shutdown of the world.
And for our most intense customers, 45.96 overall has been the average. Remember, for the recovery
right.
coaching, it's been 42.4. So again, we got back up to business and back up to averages pretty fast. And that's thanks to the city of Moscow allowing us to stay open, I think. Right. And the interesting thing I'd like to point out is we've got our numbers almost back to normal at a time when the University of Idaho doesn't have students on campus to a large extent. So I think we're above average. If you, think of the students we're back, because we don't see a lot of students, but we see some students.
Yeah. Well, fortunately for our radio listeners, graphs do not work or PowerPoints via the radio. But I'm sure if you graphed it out, you would see that month over month from previous years that after the complete dead zone of the March through May, June timeframe, we're servicing a lot more people.
They're busy.
Than we averaged in the same months since May and June.
We've been busy.
Yeah. There have been a lot of people here.
Yeah. And I'm pretty proud to point out that when Moscow let us be open, I think we were the only recovery center out of the nine in the state that was able to stay open throughout this entire year. I'm not saying that the others completely closed, but they didn't allow meetings going on in their centers, and they tried to do things remotely, whereas we just did our best. But my belief from day one was if the city would let us stay open, our service is important enough, you know. Well, put it this way. When I started to question whether we would be able to remain open, I contacted the city, and I think I emailed Gary Reedner, the city supervisor, and my email was really simple. I need you to advise me whether we can remain open. I don't think that my behavioral health clientele of people dealing with addictions and mental health issues will isolate well in their basements.
Isolation.
I think
is...
he quickly saw, must have seen the same thing, because word got back to me very promptly. You guys are an essential business.
Right.
In other words, you know, they didn't want to see an increase in hospital calls. They didn't want to see an increase in police calls.
Right. Right, yeah. Isolation for people in addiction.
Bad news.
And mental health, for that matter. But in my experience in addiction, isolation is the freeway on-ramp to relapse. So, yeah, and I know it was important. I know from my contacts within the AA community that people were pretty certain that relapse was going to happen unless they had some sort of outlet.
And it certainly has happened. I've seen that.
Yeah, it has. The Rural Crisis Center network, we had some huge individual numbers for that as well that go beyond the LRC numbers.
Yeah.
I don't know how
deep we can get into that. And again, I'm not the official stats guy for that. Unofficially, I believe they're averaging 8 to 10 visits per month.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I've heard comment also that as COVID hit, they saw more folks that didn't want to come in for COVID reasons,
right?
But received counseling on the phone, and I have no clue how many that was.
Maybe I'll grab Sean one of these days and get him to do a little segment with us on how that's looked. But I know it's been a significant and important part of the overall function of the building here, so to speak. So what does the future look like right now in your eyes for the recovery center? And
we've got a couple outreaches we've been pushing. I kind of referred to them earlier when I talked about what our staff are doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I really want to grow what we're doing with students here in town. And in multiple ways. Number one, we've traditionally run on volunteers, and COVID has impacted that significantly.
Sure.
But we had a lot of students step up as interns.
Oh.
I'd like to continue to develop that intern aspect of the program as the volunteers come back, hopefully from COVID. So a more formalized intern program, I think, is coming up. And we've already taken steps towards that, in fact. Also, again, regarding students, that student outreach we're doing with the office that's in St. Augustine's, I'd like to grow that. Students' needs aren't being met with an office that's open Monday was 1 to 3.
Right.
That's not when addiction happens. Addiction happens 24/7. So I'd like to grow that.
And
I should add, we're working, that's not just us, that's us working in conjunction with Vandal Health.
Right, right.
So that's an important partnership with the college. It's not just us saying, hey, we're here to help. It's the college saying, help together to develop this.
And they've got a wellness ambassador program that we're a part of.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting to see. Interesting year to kick it off with COVID, but you work when you got to work.
That's right. That's right.
So that, and then I also mentioned the rural outreach. What did AA look like, Johnny, say 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago in the rural communities? Was there different AA groups, just as a for instance?
There were, there have been smaller groups in the rural areas. I can think of two in particular. One, believe it or not, in a fellow's garage in Beauville.
I believe it.
On a Saturday night. Another one in Deary that was at a church there. And yeah. I think there was one in Potlatch way back a while ago.
But they
kind of died out because, you know, Beauville's population of what, 17, 18? I'm not sure. But it's very small. And so to consistently support, any kind of recovery meeting, you know, AA is what I'm familiar with. You know, you got to have a core of dedicated people. And then, you hope people show up because the program's based on attraction rather than promotion.
Right. And the tradition of having the meeting just keep going and going has kind of died. And once a tradition dies, you got to build new traditions. One vision that I have for the rural that I'm trying to slowly implement or have the staff slowly implement is taking advantage of Zoom. You were talking about you have to have a group.
Right.
In order to get that cohesion, fellowship. And it's going to be hard to get a big group in Beauville or in any of our small towns.
Right.
But if we could get everybody meeting, say, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and have the Beauville people meeting Beauville, the Genesee people meeting Genesee, but then have them connected via a Zoom meeting.
Right.
And have our staff traveling maybe 1 week there in Genesee, 1 week there in Beauville, next week, rotating around kind of providing their touch. Maybe you can develop more of that fellowship again.
Right.
And then use that to spur up those groups to becoming their own self-functioning entity.
Right, exactly. That's a great vision. I know Zoom has been a fabulous tool for AA and NA in this area. Although, there's that the second A of AA is anonymous, and there are certain people that just a little bit nervous about, being zoomed in person. However, Zoom can be set up so that your face doesn't show and your name can be whatever you want. But I think, using the technology is a great thing as a starting point. Still, I'm kind of old school, and I think that, having that human one-on-one face-to-face thing
is still critical. Right there
but
with you.
As a tool to get things going and get things started, I think, when I first came into the AA rooms 27 years ago.
What you guys couldn't see was him quickly whipping off his socks and help tilt the
camera. That's right. And other bits of clothing we won't go into. That little more anonymity of being able to just kind of like zoom in and listen from afar made me a little more comfortable to walk into the room because I've told the story before. I stood in the parking lot, outside the back of a church where I saw people smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee, which is the high sign for an AA meeting if you're looking for one. And there was something just holding me back until a man came out and said, "Hey, are you looking for an AA meeting?" And I grudgingly, nervously said yes. And he put his arm on my shoulder and said, "Come on in." So it worked. It worked just perfectly. Well, that is just about it for us. Unless you have a final thought. Yes, perfectly. Well, I'm going to edit most of this out. Mostly you.
That would make most sense. I always ask him to make me sound intelligent, which means we're going to be down to 15 seconds worth of a show here. So, yeah, there's that.
But nonetheless, thank you so much, Daryl, for sharing this information.
Absolutely, Johnny.
It's important to get it out. We share calendar and things like that on here, but having a little idea of what goes on
I'm always
behind the curtain.
Recovery Radio. It's fun.
All right. All right, well, that's it for us today. And, you know, remember, if you think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, you do.